Today is February 14th, and it's our last class on the philosophy of Rabbi Yitz Greenberg. We've been studying the subject of theodicy and providence for a good 2 years, and at the end of our study, we've been focusing on post-Holocaust literature. And at the end of our study of post-Holocaust literature on this subject, we've studied Rav Yitz Greenberg. And at the end of the study of Rav Yitz Greenberg, we're looking at this essay called Voluntary Covenant, and we're going to finish that essay today. And then in the future, we begin a completely new subject. So I'm looking at the handouts that I gave with my summary on them. If you don't have it, that's okay, but if you do have it, it's even better. It says at the top, Voluntary Covenant. And I'm going to read from the third page of that in the middle. The middle of the third page of my summary, my handout on Voluntary Covenant. The middle of the third page, it says, The Holocaust.
Was there a third page?
No,
When I say the third page, I mean in my own typewritten page, not in the words of Rav Yitz.
Well, no, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah. I wasn't here last week, and I'm thinking that you're there must be, because this came out on January 31st, and it's only 2 pages.
I see.
So
you don't have it.
I guess I'll have to just listen very carefully.
Right.
I have a document that I have stapled together that are 2 pages, but in fact, since they're both back and front, there's 1, 2, 3, 4 pages.
Right, that's it. So the third side. The third side.
Starts with the secular Zionist.
That's the current page. So halfway down, you'll see the Holocaust.
I got it.
Concerning the Holocaust, God promised that there would always be a covenant people to keep the covenant. But God failed us in the covenant. In the Holocaust, the covenant might seem to be over. As Rav Yitz said, God failed to make sure there would always be a covenant people. Furthermore, in the next paragraph, Rav Yitz pointed out the following. The Holocaust is the final proof that the covenant is untenable and morally problematic. The covenant opens the Jewish people to a murderous fury from which there is no escape. If God does not protect us from this fury, then the covenant is nothing more than a death pact, a suicide mission which is morally untenable. There was no such clause in the contract. In other words, when we were given the Torah, or when God made the covenant with Abraham, it didn't say that this is a suicide mission. God must repent of the covenant. Rav Yitz used language that strong. God can no longer consider us obligated in the covenant. And practically speaking, no divine punishment can enforce the covenant. Whatever he can threaten for disobedience, we have already received for obedience. Mo.
I think the covenant, I have to fix in my mind which covenant he's talking about. Because if you talk about the covenant with Abraham, that could conceivably include Muslims as well, because Ishmael was Abraham's son, right? I think he's referring to the covenant at Sinai.
Yes, he's referring to the whole package with the Jewish people.
This is specifically with the Jewish people.
Yes, absolutely.
Specifically.
Absolutely, right. Yeah. For me, that last line that I just read is especially powerful. We know that the covenant in the Torah mentions a number of times blessings and curses, and there are curses, there's punishment for not keeping the covenant. Rav Yitz points out that all that is totally irrelevant anymore, because all of those curses were already brought upon the Jewish people, not for disobedience, but for obedience. So that's pretty powerful. So then he writes, and of course this is a review for us, we had every right in the wake of the Holocaust to abandon the covenant. But the overwhelming majority of Jews did not. Continued Jewish identity and self-sacrifice and charity are expressions of voluntary renewal of the covenant even after its authority was broken. God can no longer command, but we Jews are renewing the covenant out of love. In doing so, we are bringing the covenant to a higher level. And this is not a recommendation of Rav Yitz, it's simply, in his mind, a snapshot of reality. This is what happened. Reality showed us that the covenant is no longer binding, but the Jewish people didn't take the hint and didn't go someplace else. They stayed committed. Which is, of course, a higher level of commitment because nothing is forcing us. And not only is nothing forcing us, but a lot of factors are pushing us in the opposite direction because we know that it's completely dangerous to be a Jew. But still, we are Jewing. We are Jewing. I'll just tell you about that expression. When I was about 10, 11, or 12 years old, and I used to go to synagogue 3 or 4 times a year with my parents. We lived in a Reform synagogue, went to a Reform synagogue on Long Island. The rabbi used to publish the topic of his sermon a week before, so everyone knew what they were coming for. And I remember the name of one of his sermons, which was, "How Do You Jew?"
If anybody else used that expression, like a Christian said, "You're Jew," I would think they were putting me down.
Right. If you look at some of the stuff that young people are doing, you look at stuff that Leonard Fine said years ago, they use "How do you Jew?" How do you act as a Jew?
Yes. So anyway, so Rav Yitz, and I'll stop reading now, pointed out many, many times in the essay that under these circumstances of voluntary covenant, it doesn't matter how do you Jew. It doesn't matter because it's all a matter of our voluntarily taking upon ourselves the framework of the covenant. Whatever you do is good. Even if it's just identification as a Jew and nothing else, that's good. Even if it's just living in Israel, that's good. And the truth is, Rav Yitz says that living in Israel is more than good. It's fantastic. It's the ultimate sacrifice because you know that you're opening up yourself and your children to being killed for being an Israeli, for being a Jew. And no greater sacrifice can anyone offer for himself. No greater commitment. And that's about a summary of what we saw last time. And we're going to read on now. We're going to go forward. And the place we left off is at the bottom of page 36, where it says, "Was the Holocaust necessary?" The bottom of 36 of Rav Yitz's own essay, we would begin right there now, "Was the Holocaust necessary?" But I'm going to do some skipping. And we're actually going to read at the first third of page 37. It's about 12 or 13 lines down, the top of 37. He begins a new paragraph that begins with the words "the same." Do you see those words "the same"?
Yes.
So I'm not going to read the first sentence of the paragraph, but just the second sentence. Just the second sentence. In retrospect, the voluntary stage is implicit in the covenantal model from the very beginning. Once God self-limits out of respect for human dignity, once human free will is accepted, the ultimate logic is a voluntary covenant. Right? That's a very important line. That Rav Yitz is saying that his theology of voluntary covenant is actually a consummation of ideas implicit in the covenant theology from the very, very beginning. Right? From the very beginning, there was a certain divine limitation in order to have another party to the covenant, the Jewish people. The whole Torah really is about divine limitation and granting a free will. And the more free will, of course, the more powerful the covenant, as he's told us many times. So the stage we reach today, which is completely and absolutely voluntary, there's no threat of punishment, because as we said, no punishment could be as bad as we already got. And that, so it's really the highest level, and it's always been implicit in the covenant from the very beginning. As Soloveitchik writes, "The very validity of the covenant rests upon the juridic halachic principle of free negotiations, mutual assumption of duties, and full recognition of the equal rights of both parties concerned with the covenant. So Rav Yitz here can understand himself as only fleshing out what his teacher, Rabbi Soloveitchik, wrote, was only fleshing out what was implicit there from the beginning. The full dignity of the human partner can only emerge when that partner takes full responsibility. Any state less than that is encouragement to dependence out of weakness. Residual punishment is coercive and erodes the moral insight of the human partner. Right? What he means to say there is that punishment that's written in the Torah, well, we understand why it's written, to get you to do the mitzvot. But in the deepest sense, that threat of punishment actually takes away from the full power of the covenant, because there's always the possibility that people are keeping the stuff, not because they really want and believe and are committed, but because they're being forced. They are afraid of punishment. And of course, the model is marriage. What type of marriage is it when one party is staying there because they feel coerced into it? Where they feel coerced because they'll lose a lot of money if they go for a divorce, or they'll lose custody of the children, or they are afraid they'll be punished by the other party. There'll be revenge taken. That takes away from the true meaning of the marriage. The same thing says Rav Yitz with the Jewish people. So the voluntary covenant is certainly a higher level, because we know we can walk away from it at any single time. So every minute we stay with it shows that it's for real. In a voluntary covenant, there is a deeper dependence, that of relationship, love, self-expectations based on the model of the other, but it is a dependence out of strength. Right? It's that you want the other party. You don't need the other party, you want the other party. Because it's good for you. The Jewish people don't need God anymore, as it were. Because God, right, all He brought upon us is destruction. It's not that we need God, it's rather we want God. We want the meaning of the covenant. And that makes it more powerful, more meaningful.
I don't think He brought about the destruction, but He didn't do anything to
yes,
stop it.
That's what I meant. You're right.
How do you have a covenant that is accepted by one party and not necessarily accepted by the other? I mean, we have no indication that God wants to continue this covenant, and we say this is the higher level because we want to continue it, because even in spite of the fact that we have no great amount to gain from it, but, you know, that's like using marriage as an example, that's like having a marriage ceremony and the groom doesn't show up.
Let me think about that for a moment. Well, there are two parts to it. One part we discussed last week and one part we didn't. So, the part we discussed last week, we also discussed in the past, which was always Jay's question, which is, what's the meaning of this if God is not active? And that was my whole, if you remember, my whole parable about the family of musicians, the piano players. So, in that parable, Joe, do you remember that parable? Did I mention it 2 weeks ago? I think I did, briefly.
Here. Joe didn't hear.
I wasn't here last week, so I missed that parable.
So, to make a long story short, I talked about this family, a couple, husband and wife, who are great world-known pianists. And they raise a young daughter, their daughter, and she also has great talent and becomes a great pianist, and the parents teach her and develop her and nurture her. And clearly, as the child grows older, she becomes more independent. The parents play a lesser and lesser role in her going on stage, in her practicing, in her appearances, of course. By the age of 50, when the parents are already in their 80s, so the parents play no active role except as fans, except as spectators. And she's changing the world with her beautiful music, the 50-year-old woman. But you can still say that she's in covenant with the parents, because they, although they're not active at all, they want what she's doing. They pass the values of music on to her, and she always understands herself as in relationship to her parents, even though it's not an active relationship, but she sees herself as fulfilling her covenant with them. And it's a meaningful covenant for her, simply because she decided to continue it. They're spectators, but they're still important. She remembers them as role models. So to me, that's very important. But now you say something else, which is, how do we know that the parents haven't repudiated the covenant? I know they're not active, but how do we know they haven't repudiated the covenant? In the sense that they don't like the piano anymore. They want to play the viola. Or they want to switch from music to lacrosse or football. So I don't have an answer for that. Except the Jewish belief in the eternal validity of the covenant based on the Torah.
It seems to me that if we're going to use these kinds of parables, it's more like the parent who abandoned their child, and the child wants to continue loving their parent in spite of the fact that the parent abandoned them, and so the child's half of the covenant exists. But the parent is off in Hawaii on the beach and doesn't really even care what's going on. Now, how do we know that's not the applicable parable if the other side of the covenant is not demonstrating an interest in what we're doing, how we're doing it, and telling us... you know, even though in the parable you're talking about, the parents are at least, they're applauding the child, but if the guy's out there at the beach, he's not even doing that. So, how do we know that God hasn't abandoned us and is really no longer interested in a covenant?
I hear what you're saying. I'm going to take your version of the parable and I'm going to respond with a compromised version of it. I would say it's something like this. I would say that at the age of 25, the child feels that the parent has abandoned them and gone to the beach in Hawaii. But there's another possibility, that the parents came to the conclusion that at this stage, the best thing for the child is to let her be on her own and independent. And then it depends on the child how she is going to interpret what happened. She can interpret it as an abandonment, or she can grow up and interpret it as an effort by the parent to help her grow. Now, that's certainly the way Rav Yitz would look at it. And he is obviously... can you hear still? You can hear me? And Rav Yitz is obviously rooting for the paradigm that says that the parent has not abandoned the children, and the children should not interpret it as abandonment, but should interpret it as, again, an effort to help the child grow up. But I agree, there's no proof. And it almost looks like Rav Yitz is on the edge at certain points. And he does use language sometimes. He brings the language of Elie Wiesel.
I have to tell you that I'm impressed with the way you twisted around my parable.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
That was good.
But I take it seriously. I take seriously what you said. Okay.
One quick question. In what we read just a moment ago about the principle of free negotiation, mutual assumption of duties, and full recognition of the equal rights of both parties. The equal rights of both parties. I don't really understand that. I mean, as it applies to God.
It's certainly a very, very audacious statement that Rav Yitz makes, and he feels that it is a natural outgrowth of Jewish...
This is Soloveitchik.
Right, right. Very good point. Let me, based on what Jay just said, let me stop for a minute and tell a story, which is that this past Thursday night, only 7 days ago when I was in Dallas, and I participated in our first Faiths in Conversation event in the dialogue between Muslims, Christians, and Jews. The topic was something very related to this. The topic was divine authority and personal conscience. The question being, in the face of a God who commands, is there any room for human beings to have input into what they do and how they live their lives? So in my presentation, which was rather elaborate, I spoke for 5 minutes about the model of God as commander and the Akedah, in which God commands Avraham to kill his son, and Avraham is willing to do it. He completely submits. But then, most of my presentation, I pointed out that Judaism develops this in a different direction and goes, based on the Tanakh, on the Bible, goes in the direction that human beings have to grow up, become mature children, and not act like sheep with their parents, but become the co-equals of God as mature children who take the divine values and apply them. So I just want to tell you that the Muslim imam was totally and absolutely scandalized by what he said. What I said, he didn't speak angrily, but with a little smile on his face, he said, "From the point of view of Islam, what I said is blasphemy." So indeed, in Judaism, we have this strange concept, which goes right back to Genesis with Avram arguing against God. When God says he's going to destroy the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, we have this strange Jewish concept of growing up and learning to confront God, to grapple with God, and to express our understandings, although humbly, but express them with a certain degree of confidence. And what we have here in the text is really just the maturation of that idea.
But you know, Rabbi, we sort of glorify that that's a, you know, was such a great attribute of Abraham that he argued with God for the lives of these people in Sodom and Gomorrah. But then, of course, when he doesn't argue for the life of his own child, that just is so hard for me to put together.
Yes, you're right. We have these two poles here. We absolutely do. And in Rabbi Soloveitchik's thinking, by the way, he always contrasts those two poles, that there's an element of submission and obedience, and then there's an element of assertion and self-confidence. I don't know... Say it again?
When we're supposed to be submissive or when we're supposed to be assertive.
Right. There's no answer to that. There's no answer to that, I don't think. But what we do understand is how Jewish tradition developed this idea that we're supposed to not only be submissive, but there also is room and a need and a value in human independence and human thought. So actually, I worked out in my lecture, I tried to show how Judaism tries to find a balance between the idea of submission on the one hand and the idea of self-assertion on the other hand. You can listen to it online when it's put online.
I was there. I heard it.
You were there.
I was there.
You were there Thursday night?
Yes, I was.
Carol Ann, I didn't know that.
Jay was there too. Yeah.
I don't remember.
And I talked to the imam afterwards, and he was very nice. Well, he's not an imam, but
right.
The Muslim person. He's very slick. And he says that, that in fact, you know, I asked him, why are the voices so quiet, you know, Muslim voices so quiet with regard to all the terrorists, Islamic terrorists. And he said that it is improving. He's got a blog that reaches a lot of people all around the world, and that young people are saying to him things like, well, I didn't know that, and they're sort of coming around to his, a more Islamic, perhaps, way of thinking.
Yeah. I just
anyway,
lost... Yeah.
I'm on subject now, I know.
So I just want to apologize because I don't... Did I talk to you that night?
No, I don't think so. Well, yes, because, you came up and that one lady had a question about how can... If there's so many different... What did she ask? So
yeah.
Different,
I remember now. Uh-huh. I remember now.
And
thank
how
you.
Do you know... I forgot exactly what she asked you, but something about... If you have so many 70 different ways that we can look at something, how do you know
right.
which is the right
way? Yes, I remember.
Which is sort of interesting. How do we know when there's so many different ways to look at something?
They're all the right way.
They're all the right.
Yeah, to it. That's true. I'm going to go back to reading.
But yeah.
Just before we leave this, you know, the nature of a covenant or a contract usually has parameters. And the idea that you have a contract for which there are no parameters sort of suggests that there's no contract. I mean, what is the covenant, so to speak, unless you have, I'm going to do this and you're going to do that, an agreement. So this idea of equal rights for both parties is a bit vague to me, but go ahead. That was just something that...
I hear. Let me just say a word concerning what you just said, Jay, which is that for Rav Yitz, the covenant has two sections. It has the goals and it has the means. And Rav Yitz is saying that the means that are written in the contract are no longer binding. But as long as anyone devotes themselves to the goals of the covenant, then he's in the covenant.
Say that last phrase.
As long as a human being, a Jew, devotes themselves to the goals of the covenant, then that person is in the covenant, even if he doesn't follow the means that the covenant had listed, because that particular contract is now completely voluntary. So remember, Rav Yitz had said... Yeah?
Go ahead.
Rav Yitz had said that the goal of the covenant is to increase the dignity and the sanctity and the richness of human life. That's was the purpose of God's covenant from the very beginning. And the whole Torah is all about promoting human life and human dignity. The means that the Torah gave us, are God's means, but that particular covenant with those means is no longer binding. So now whatever someone does to advance those values in the framework of the Jewish people, that's good. And even if the only thing the person does is identify as a Jew, that's also good, because he's saying, even though he doesn't know that he's saying this, he's saying, I'm part of the movement that's supposed to bring the world towards those ultimate goals. And that's enough.
You know, I was reminded in a way in some of your near the closing remarks in your lecture on My Messiah, Their Messiah, in which you quoted from, I think it was Matthew, that Jesus said that this is a new deal.
Right.
A new relationship. So, there seems to be a bit of a parallel in modern times about Yitz's idea of this new deal as it was 2,000 years ago.
Isn't Yitz saying that we now have to negotiate a new covenant?
Well, just wait a second. Jay said something so powerful, I just want to think about it for a few seconds. So just give me a few seconds to absorb what you said. Jay, that's very powerful what you said. And really, Jay, what you said just now, it prefigures some of Rav Yitzchak's later writings in which he says just what you said. In other words, in later writings, since Rav Yitzchak wrote the essay we're reading now, he has said that in the modern era, we Jews may want to consider the possibility that Christianity is part of the same covenant.
Wow, that is strong.
Because it's really true. They're saying that they're advancing, they want to advance the same goals, but they have a different means of doing it.
Yes.
Or let's say they claim that God has given them a different path to realizing it. And Rav Yitzchak basically says that Christian claim that they have a new covenant, meaning a new set of means to advance the same goal, Rav Yitzchak says, I am willing to accept that, what Christians say, as long as in saying that they don't repudiate our way.
Okay. All right. What is the difference between what we're saying here, the Jewish position, and the atheist that is moral and ethical?
I'll tell you the difference. The atheist who's moral and ethical is equivalent in my parable about the family of piano teachers to the 50-year-old pianist who's now a world-famous pianist and she believes that her parents are dead. Whereas Rav Yitzchak says the parents are alive.
Well, but if we're including in the covenant anybody who acts to fulfill the goals of the covenant as being part of the covenant,
I think, let's go back to the pianist for a minute. The 50-year-old pianist doesn't think her parents are dead. She thinks her parents have nothing to do with it. That her talent was something that was innate in her and that she's totally responsible for.
Okay, that's a good point. That's good. I was thinking of the atheist. I was thinking of the God is dead. That God existed, but he's dead now. But you're right, Mo.
The atheist believes that that man by himself, through his reason, can comes to moral conclusions.
Okay.
It's got nothing to do with God.
But I'm talking about what Yitz's position with respect to Christianity is saying that any actions that are actions towards the covenantal goal is a covenantal action, and the Christians have another path towards the same goal.
But the Christians are saying it's also the will of God.
Well,
God is in the equation.
Okay. Well, you're saying that why do I have to have God in the equation if the definition is anything I do that is towards the goal of the covenant is covenantal?
Well, you don't even accept it if you're an atheist. If you're God, but I'm a statement like Christopher Hitchens was. God's got nothing to do with that.
You wouldn't believe that there was, I guess an atheist would not believe there was even a covenant.
Yeah, it's got nothing to do with covenant. It's got to do with what you would.
Rabbi wants to say something.
What you're saying is all true, but Rav Yitzchak is going to say, I don't remember if it's a part we're skipping or not, that the atheist who lives according to the values of the covenant, even if he doesn't admit to a covenant, that person for Rav Yitzchak is just as much as part of the covenantal people as anyone else.
Okay, but that brings in another thing which Rav Yitzchak might get to. But I know it's part of Hartman's tradition. Is saying, as long as you believe you're a part of the Jewish people, you may not observe any of the what we call rituals, but you behave in a moral way. You're living within the covenant.
Yes. Yes. Okay, we're going to read now where we left off, in the middle of page 37, on the left-hand column. The words we're beginning with are the ultimate logic. Do you see those words, the ultimate logic?
Yes.
Yes.
The ultimate logic of parenting is to raise children to meet life's challenges, but to sustain them with a continuing presence and model, not with continual interference or rescue from problems. Further analysis suggests that in every covenantal relationship, the partners must ultimately choose between equality and force. You cannot have both. Any coercion, any threats, takes away from equality, which takes away from the true depth of the relationship. True love can only exist when the imbalance of power has been overcome by redistribution of power, or, in God's case, by a binding renunciation of using the imbalance. So
is
we
it ever Jewish guilt?
So Rav Yitzchak understands that from the witness of history, we've learned that God has renounced the use of any force in this covenant, whether forcing us to keep the mitzvot or force to save us from enemies. It's not going to happen. God is the parent in this, in the bleachers watching and hoping and rooting and crying and cheering, but not intervening. We're going to skip all of page 37. And we're going to page 38 on the right-hand side. Where it says, in the new era. It's about 15 lines down from the top. Okay?
Okay.
In the new era, the voluntary covenant is the theological base of a genuine pluralism. Which is clear, right? If we really believe that it's all voluntary, then we don't have to have disrespect for those who take upon themselves voluntarism different than our voluntarism. It's all good. Pluralism is not a matter of tolerance made necessary by living in a non-Jewish reality, nor is it pity for one who does not know any better. In that line about the pity, Rav Yitz is heaping sarcasm on the ultra-Orthodox version of tolerance, in which they say that we can't hold it against you if you are not Orthodox, because we have pity on you, we'll help you back. But there's no deep respect for who the person is, where they are. Pity is not the same thing as respect. It is a recognition that all Jews have chosen to make the fundamental Jewish statement at great personal risk and cost. Right? Pluralism begins with me recognizing that every Jew has made a very, very, very big step just by agreeing to be a Jew. The present denominations are paths for the covenant-minded, all leading toward the final goal. Look at that, he just said what I said in his name 2 minutes ago. Looking at the goal and looking at the means. I'll read that line again. The present denominations, Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, are paths for the covenant-minded, all leading toward the final goal. The controversy between them will not be whether God has commanded these ways. Conservative, Reform, and secular Jews can freely concede the dimensions of past commandments, but insist nevertheless that these are no longer effective or optimal ways of achieving the goals. It doesn't work anymore. We're continuing on the same path, towards the same goals, but perhaps with different means. Orthodox Jews, even the ultra-right, who uphold every past observance or minhag, will recognize, and Rav Yitz means they should recognize, that their commitment to observe the entire tradition constitutes a voluntary acceptance, one which can be modeled but cannot be demanded of all. Thus, they can be faithful to the full authority of the halakha, accepting the challenge of modeling it and making it credible and persuasive to Klal Yisrael, while respecting the incredible other types of commitment and contributions which other Jews are making. Such an admission would only confirm the phenomenology of Jewish life as it is now being lived. That's the way it is today. That's we Jews don't kill others who are not doing what we do. But Rav Yitz says that we should actually put a stamp of approval on the current situation, which each does their own thing. It would be morally and humanly liberating without yielding the hope of moving Klal Yisrael into the classic paths of halakha. In other words, the Orthodox person can continue wanting to move everyone in the direction of the halakha, but should do it understanding that it's a modeling in which I want to persuade you to follow my means, but it's not a statement that my means are more godly than your means. Of course, the psychology of Orthodoxy currently will not be receptive to this approach, but such an obstacle is not a problem of principle or integrity. Rather, it's a function of human limitations, community, and political needs, all of which can be dealt with tactically. Just think about that for a few seconds. Okay. It would be unreasonable, and considering the varieties of religious experience and sociological circumstances, unwise to expect total religious unity. Different Jews are going to do different things.
You know, let me stop you for a minute.
Okay.
I certainly agree with his position here. On Sunday morning, I went to hear the Dayan, and he would not agree with this.
I understand.
Not agree with this. His opening statement. Let me just tell you what his opening statement was. We have become a society in which everybody is talking about rights. They want human rights, they want civil rights, they want social rights, they want rights. Judaism is not a religion of rights, it's a religion of obligations. End of story. Yes is saying things have changed. The Holocaust is certainly the great watershed.
No, I'm gonna think about what you just said. Let me think a few seconds. Wow.
The chief judge, they have the best thing for all of Britain and for Europe, and he's the head judge. And by the way, it's quite regular. I don't mean modern organized. Yeah. Yeah, a little bit beyond his stuff.
So, Mo, I don't completely agree with you.
That's okay.
But I want to engage in a discussion.
I'm not sure I do completely agree with me either, but that's beside the point.
So, certainly, historically, we agree that what the Dayan spoke is true, historically.
The reading, if I do a literal reading of the Torah, that's without question true. The Torah is not a democratic program.
Well, I would leave democracy out of it. It's not about rights, it's about obligations. And
it's about obligations, but on the other side, look, if the Torah says 36 times, I think, you should be kind to the widow, the orphan, and to the stranger, That gives the widow, the orphan, the stranger a right to be expect to be treated properly and kindly. On the side, do not put a stumbling block before the blind. If I'm blind, I have a right to expect, a right not to have a stumbling block, but a legal right not to have a stumbling block put before me.
I'm not sure that that's true.
Well, not right.
Let me give you an example. We're getting a little bit off course, but I'll just say this briefly. If I owe you $50, that doesn't give you a right to take the $50 from me.
No, that's true. That's true. Well, let me go on to another point. Because it's much, much more central, as I think of it. He decried the fact that there's no central authority in the United States. For what? He said for Jews.
Okay.
There's no central authority in the United States. He thinks it's terrible. He thinks we're too fractionated, too fractionalized. Well, the truth is that he may think there's a central authority for Jews in Great Britain, but that's not true either.
You're right. That I agree 100%. He is implicitly redefining the Jewish people to only that group that he deals with.
Yeah,
in what? Yes. That group that what? He deals with.
Yeah. Anyway, we've got to finish up in the next hour.
Okay, so we are right there on page 38. And I'm reading, I'm just finding the place. Right, Orthodox Jews. Oh, right, we got to the bottom.
Right, bottom of that paragraph.
Right, I'll read that last paragraph again at the bottom of 38. It would be unreasonably, and considering the varieties of religious experience and sociological circumstance, unwise to expect total religious unity. There can still be ongoing controversies and policy differences between the denominations, but the members of all the groups have committed their total being to be witness to the covenant by living as Jews. The recognition of this overarching unity enables us to adjudge these controversies as being for the sake of heaven.
Well, then it raises another issue.
Say it again?
It raises another issue which has been written about time and time again. What is meant by living as Jews?
That was going to be my question.
Self-identification?
Yes, he means self-identification. That's all he means. That's what he means.
Okay.
In the Talmud, the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel often gave diametrically opposite rulings. Yet they affirm that both views are the words of the living God, precisely because they recognize the underlying unit of their common assumptions about the nature of God in Revelation. The unity which was destroyed in the modern period is restored in the common recognition of the voluntary covenant. Rav Yitz says, if all Jews could only agree on my understanding of the covenant that is now voluntary, then even though everyone would behave differently, we'd have a basis for unity. Which is, of course, true, but we all know, and he knows also, that many, many Jews are not going to accept his understanding that the covenant is now voluntary. Groups can go on judging and trying to persuade each other to change, but the criteria for resolution of the conflict will be the ability to reach the goal of the covenant, including contemporary effectiveness and transmissibility. In other words, we're not going to judge the other by saying, that's not a proper interpretation, that's not what God commanded, that's not what God said. We can judge the other on different criteria. Does it advance the world towards the goal of the covenant? Does it work? Orthodoxy might concede that a particular practice is not effective today. However, they continue to accept it as binding out of respect for past generations and their role in the covenant. out of the sense that this generation is only a way station on the long covenantal road. They can accept temporary ineffectiveness of a practice in one moment in order to have the resource available in another. To me, that's a very important statement. Let me say it in my own words. He says that one can accept and believe in the continuing necessity of keeping the whole halachic system, not because all the details actually advance the covenant in the present age, but out of a belief that keeping the system intact as a whole system is important for the future of the Jewish people, so that eventually we will be able to best realize the covenantal goals.
So that's why sharpness is an important issue for the Orthodox.
That's why it's an important issue for Rav Yitz. For them it's an important issue because they think that God is binding them to keep it.
No, that's my point.
Yeah.
That's my
point. The definition of being Orthodox might be accepting the models of the past as binding out of recognition of the incredible divine power in them, and being bound by the process of the covenant, a process seen as inseparable from its goals and content. Now that's what orthodoxy is for him. It's keeping the system because of the past and because it works as a system in the long run, but not out of a conviction that it works in the short run. And of course that describes Rav Yitz very well, because he believes in the short run the present system, the orthodox system, is not working and has to be greatly changed. But out of respect for the integrity of the system, out of belief that the best way to get where we're going is by having a system, a binding system, therefore he would describe himself as orthodox. Then the differences with non-orthodox Jews are tactical. Perhaps I'll just stop there for a second. Right? He's saying that for him, the difference between Orthodox, conservative, and Reform are tactical differences, not essential differences. We all agree in the goals of the covenant, and we all agree that it's a voluntary covenant, but we have different tactics of how to reach the final goals. He sees Orthodoxy, conservative, and Reform as tactics, but not ultimately as different belief systems. I'll just read that sentence again.
Okay, let me argue with one point you made, one little sliver. Certainly, I can't speak to the modern Orthodox world, but certainly to the ultra-Orthodox world. The statement, they all see the covenant as voluntary. I don't think the ultra-Orthodox would see the covenant as voluntary.
No, of course you're right, of course you're right. He's urging for a new paradigm.
Yeah.
Right? He's agitating for a new paradigm.
Right, but in his view, Orthodoxy is voluntary as well. Or Orthodoxy's view is...
No. He knows what other people think. He's saying the way he would like to define it.
Okay.
He would like Orthodox people to redefine what they're doing and not see it as essentially different than what Reform and Conservative's doing.
Okay.
The definition of being Orthodox might be.
So I'm going to read that sentence again. Then the differences with non-Orthodox Jews are tactical. An other's faithfulness to God and to the covenant can be admitted without undermining Orthodox affirmations. Now understand, the orthodoxy that Rav Yitz is agitating for is an orthodoxy that is accepted in the modern world by one person. What's his name? Yitz Greenberg. But let me just tell you shortly that going back 1,000 years ago, the Rambam wrote that there are three different ways to understand rabbinic agadah, right? Rabbinic stories. Perhaps you heard this from me once. One way, says the Rambam, is to take them literally and believe them. Right? Take the story of the oven that we all know, which they argued over the purity of the oven. And it tells about the carob tree being uprooted, and a voice coming out of heaven, and the water moving the opposite direction. Right? So some people take that literally and believe it. That's way number one. Number two is take it literally and therefore disbelieve it. Because if that's what the rabbis really thought, then they're crazy. Okay? And then the third way is taking it figuratively and understanding there's a deeper truth in it. Those are the three ways of understanding Agadah. You still with me?
Yes.
And then the Rambam says that the third group is analogous to the group of the sun. There's only one member in the group of the sun, that's the sun. S-U-N. The sun in the sky. So Rambam's basically saying that 50% of the Jews believe the Agadah is literally true and they accept it. 50% say that it is meant to be literally true and therefore they reject it. And then there's one person who says it's an allegory. That's me, the Rambam. I'm a group like the sun is a group. There's one member of the... So the same thing with Rav Yitz. Except that Rav Yitz has one person that agrees with him to a certain degree, which is me.
Well, Rambam has at least one person that agrees with him also.
That's true. Jay.
Rabbi, it seems rather than saying that he's more akin to his vision or version of orthodoxy, that it would be quite the contrary, that his view is more akin to Reform Judaism, which has, in some respects, not completely as he said, that the covenant as it existed is not one that we have to comply with completely. I know that orthodoxy has kind of Reform has returned more toward a simple version, but in general, the concept of Reform seems to be one which is not even as far as Greenberg would go, therefore he would side more with Reform rather than orthodoxy.
I understand. Rav Yitz is defining himself as orthodox from a practical point of view, from the point of view of behavior. Rav Yitz behaves orthodoxly and he self-identifies orthodoxly. He lives within the orthodox community. And the truth is really that it's been that way for a good 100, 200 years. That the fault lines between the movements are ultimately fault lines of behavior. It's true that there is behind it theology, but it's... You can't hear me.
Okay.
So, Rav Yitz is really orthopraxis, right? He's not orthodox because he doesn't accept the orthodox beliefs. Orthodox means correct belief. Orthopraxis means correct behavior. Rav Yitz is a member of the orthopraxis community.
Orthopraxis, yeah. It's kind of a medical term. It's maybe a disease.
Okay, so let's read on. Let's finish this last paragraph about orthodoxy. Rav Yitz says, once the validity of the others is recognized, that the Orthodox recognize the validity of Reform and Conservative, once the validity of the others is recognized, the shortcomings or faults in the halachic system can be admitted and to the extent possible corrected. As long as the legitimacy of the others is not recognized, many problems will be denied and possible solutions rejected on the grounds that the change would give aid and comfort to the enemy. In other words, right? I think it's pretty clear. I see Caroline is nodding her head. When one movement sees the other as an enemy that has to be fought against, then we can't make any concessions. We can't learn from them because we're afraid of giving them ground. And therefore, to Rav Yitz, it's clear that there are many, many practical things that Orthodoxy should learn from Reform and Conservative, but Orthodoxy is unable to learn because it's afraid of giving legitimacy to the enemy.
Are we talking about Reform and Orthodox, or are we talking about Republicans and Democrats?
We're talking really about both, you're right. We absolutely are. We absolutely are. By the same token, Reform, Conservative, and Secular Jews would, and this means under his ideal program, would waive the modernist criteria that justify their positions. Right? He's saying that there are Jews who would say that anything that is a modern custom is by definition what I'm going to do. Just because that's what modern people do. They would waive the modernist criteria that justify their positions. This means that every part of the tradition may present itself for serious consideration to be judged by the same criteria of consistency with the covenant, transmissibility, and effectiveness. Right? A secular Jew might say that I'm not going to fast on Yom Kippur because that's what the ultra-Orthodox do and I don't want to be like them. But no, you shouldn't reject things just because they're traditional. You should have an open mind and ask yourself, does it further the goals of the covenant? Any new approaches developed by these movements will also be reviewed by the same criteria. Each movement should judge and ask itself, am I doing what needs to be done to advance the goals of the covenant? Some changes may be judged as concessions legitimated by the need to successfully negotiate the covenantal paths. And they are subject to repeal or redirection if the situation changes. So movements should be open to changing their direction. New paths or models may be as sacred or more sacred than the inherited ones if they are deemed closer to the covenantal values or more effective in attaining them. It follows from this, however, that both Reform and tradition are aligned along a continuum of attempts to live by the covenant. And no one is better than the other, as long as they're doing their best to advance the goals of the covenant. Reform behavior is not antinomian. Antinomian means, in principle, against law.
Okay.
But is distinguished from traditional Judaism by the giving of different weights to different covenantal values. He's saying that's what Reform should be. Not what it is. That's what it should be, according to his model. The increased, heavier role of women in Reform is an affirmation of the covenantal promise of redemption and ultimate dignity for women as well as men, rather than a rejection of the covenants or commandments or roles for males in tradition. He's saying that's the way we all should look at it. That's not what many people think, but that's the way we should look at it. Reform gives a greater role for women, and this, by the way, was written before the conservative movement gave a greater role to women. This was written quite a while ago. But we should understand the Reform decision as a reflection of their effort to move the covenant towards its ultimate goal, and we shouldn't see it as a rejection of traditional roles, but rather as an affirmation.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point. That's an interesting point, because conservatism decided to let women be rabbis and take more important roles as a result of what they were seeing within the Reform movement.
Uh-huh.
The way in which the Reform movement was, if you will, enriched by the presence of women rabbis and so forth.
Okay. It fits. Feminist corrections of the halakha are an attempt to move more urgently towards the covenantal goal of humankind being in the image of God, which implies equality for women, rather than a rejection of the concept of obligation or of the traditional feminine positive roles. Again, it's not a rejection, it's rather an affirmation. Once disagreements take place within the bounds of the common risk and dream of Jewish existence, the groups might take on or set aside a common practice for the sake of unity beyond the merits of the practice itself, right? All three movements might make decisions together in Rav Yitzchak's utopian understanding. Each group would be committed to use all its resources and methods to reach out and enable the others to live in good conscience with the same model, or at least not to disrupt or shatter the others' ways where they differ. At least all groups would recognize the element of risk and creativity in trying to be faithful to the covenant at a moment when new roles and new institutions are emerging. Since whatever models of service are offered tend to be projections of past experience, there is a tendency in transition times to offer the familiar even when something new or original may be needed. At moments of transformation, there is a risk of a faithfulness that misdirects, even as there is a risk of excessive novelty and betrayal of the tried and true methods of the covenant. Each group should welcome the insights and criticisms of the others as necessary correctives, sources of perspective in a fluid and unformed situation in which all want to do the right thing but fear falling short.
I think utopian really is applicable here. No way is that going to happen.
I understand, Joe. I understand. And I think, you know, Rav Yitz lives in the world. He knows that this utopian vision. But at least for me, it's inspiring and meaningful.
It certainly would be nice.
Yeah, it's very inspiring. And maybe something, I mean, something I hope we can all work towards.
Right. Watch what's happening with the other people.
Mm-hmm. That's where it
happens. That's where it.
I want to tell you guys something that I saw on YouTube this morning. For me, this morning was 8 hours ago. That so inspired me, it made me cry. The new, you know, that the Israeli Knesset now has, I think they said it's like 50% new members. Perhaps it's only 40%. People have never been members of the Knesset before. A total revolution has happened in Israel. And each new member of Knesset got 15 minutes to speak to the Knesset and introduce themselves. And I saw on YouTube the video of a new member of Knesset introducing herself, and she was my former colleague and Chavruta, who's a very famous woman in Israel now. Her name is Ruth Calderon. And she did the unspeakable. You know what she did? She taught a page of Gemara to the Knesset.
She what?
She taught a page of Gemara to the Knesset. And can you imagine a woman, a modern Israeli woman, teaching a page of Talmud in the Knesset when 15 members of the Knesset are Haredi? Right? 15 members can't imagine a woman teaching a page of Talmud because she's a woman.
And did they stay there or did they leave?
They stayed.
They stayed in Western.
Yeah. And others in the Knesset can't imagine a woman teaching Talmud because they think, because they're secular and they can't imagine that a woman would ever want to learn Talmud. And she spoke so beautifully and so inspiring. She gave such a vision for a unity of the Jewish people, each person with their own approach. But she said the Torah belongs to everyone, no matter what your understanding of it, but you have to study it, each in their own way. It was just so beautiful. I wish it was translated into English so you could, guys could see it. But certainly, Ruth Calderon standing in front of the Knesset teaching a page of Talmud would have been considered impossible and utopian 20 years ago.
So we mustn't give up.
Don't give up.
Well, you know, within Reform Judaism, there has been a movement towards more, well, I'm not going to say more orthodox attitude, but only more participation in some of the rituals that used to not have. So that it's kind
true.
Of an acceptance that the way I look at it, it's like the child that rebels, and then after a while finds out, well, maybe the parent wasn't all that wrong after all.
Yeah.
Okay, there's something to that. We're going to read on now, and what I prepared for myself to look at is now to go from page 39 to page 40 at the bottom. Page 40 at the bottom, the right-hand side, the last paragraph is what I hope to end with, and it looks like we will succeed in ending there. Of course, I suggest that everyone read this essay again in its entirety at home and think about it. But what I want to do is read the paragraph that begins, "I submit that these ills." And we'll begin with the second sentence, not the first sentence. A Messiah who is triumphant and does it all for Israel would be utterly inappropriate in such an age. What he means is, in the modern era, when human beings have taken more and more autonomy and power upon themselves, and in the Jewish covenant, we have a voluntary covenant in which we are powerful together with God, and we are more active than God, in such a time, it would be inappropriate for God to send a Messiah who did everything for us. That's the opposite of what we've been moving towards. The arrival of such a Messiah would be morally outrageous, for the Messiah would have come at the wrong time. As Elie Wiesel has written, if any Messiah was going to redeem us by divine strength, then the time to have come was during the Holocaust. Any Messiah who could have come and redeemed us and did not do so then, but chooses to come now, is a moral monster. Wiesel is right. It is too late for the Messiah to come. Therefore, we will have to bring the Messiah. Bringing the Messiah is the crowning response to the divine call for humans to take full responsibility in the covenant. End. That is so beautiful. And just to sum up, he's saying that a belief that God will send the Messiah who will make the world good, not only is that unrealistic, but it's actually at counterpoint, it's contrary to everything we've been learning. We've been learning that the covenant has shifted to human responsibility. It wouldn't make any sense now, and it wouldn't be the proper thing for a Messiah to come. Rather, our belief in the Messiah means that we are bringing the Messiah, that we are doing through our mitzvot and through our Judaism and through our Jewish identity and through all the things we do to advance the goals of the covenant. That is the meaning of the Messianic era.
Our 12 principles of faith.
13.
No, we just eliminated the 13.
The Messiah.
Well, Joe, let me tell you two things about that. One is that I have a colleague, a friend, actually he's the author of the book that I spoke about at the Learning Fest, Professor Menachem Kellner, who wrote Maimonides' Confrontation with Mysticism. He writes that the only thing in Maimonides' 13 principles of faith that throughout the generations Jews have agreed upon is that we don't accept the principles of faith. That's the only principle of faith of the Jewish people, is that we don't accept Maimonides' principles of faith. Some rabbis rejected the idea of principles at all. Others rejected the specific content of the Maimonides principles. But it's only in the past 100 years that people have actually begun to think that Judaism is based on those principles of faith. It's a completely new innovation.
If I remember correctly, I thought that Maimonides really did not want to include the phrase about the coming of the Messiah, and that he politically added it in later.
It could be that you are confusing that with the resurrection of the dead.
Yeah. Oh, maybe so. Okay.
Yeah, that was what he didn't believe in the resurrection.
Oh, okay.
So that's one point, that in any case, we don't have to worry about the principles of faith. They were never accepted. But the second point is that Rav Yitz is not repudiating the principle that we believe in the coming of the Messiah. He's just reinterpreting it.
Well, but he's reinterpreting it instead of saying the coming, it's the bringing of the Messiah.
Right.
It's going to be our actions. What he's saying is not that God is going to be sending the Messiah, it's that our actions will permit the Messiah to come.
Yes. And that's not a very far-fetched interpretation. I would say it's pretty much in line with the Rambam's own interpretation of what he meant when he wrote that.
So he meant that by our actions that we would actually create a messianic era or something like that?
Yeah, let me give an example of what I actually said at the Learning Fest on my class on Their Messiah and Our Messiah. I mentioned, remember, Rabbi Akiva, who declared Bar Kochva to be the Messiah. There is any man who advances the messianic goals successfully is by definition the Messiah in potential. And that's what Bar Kochva was until he failed. And in our sense, I don't remember if I said this at the Learning Fest or not, perhaps I did, in that sense, Ben-Gurion and Theodor Herzl and Yigal Yadin and Binyamin Netanyahu are all messianic figures in a messianic era.
Okay.
Everyone's nodding their heads. That's a great way to end with agreement. So that is what I had planned to look at in the essay today. Again, there's lots of other parts of it that are interesting and exciting, but for us, I think we completely understand the point. So we have summed up our 2.5-year study of providence and theodicy. And next week, another 2 weeks in the subject.
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey.
It's been a fantastic journey. Although I don't think we've really resolved the issue.
You've come to the wrong place if you wanted to resolve the issue. But I really have grown and learned and developed. I feel much more understanding and confident in my understanding of the world and Judaism through our study of all these sources, including Rav Yitz.
I do as well. I agree.
It's a great journey we're on.
Yes. So again, tell other people that we're being a new subject if they want to join us. Harry Kabler, or anyone else who might be free Thursday mornings, and we'll be back another 2 weeks.
A rabbi for me, who does not know where this next thing is going to go, can you give what amounts to a sentence or two about what this new study will be about?
Thank you, that's a good idea. So, Rav Mordechai Liner was a leader of a small group of Polish Hasidim in the mid-1800s. And he developed a philosophy that was considered radical in his age and is still radical within Hasidut. But for me, provides the foundations of a lot of my understanding of Judaism. He doesn't write, he spoke orally. And what we have are written records recorded by his grandson of talks he gave probably on Shabbat. Talks he gave on Shabbat in Yiddish that were translated into Hebrew and recorded much later. They are fragmentary and they're based on very, very convoluted exegesis. What he says is really not what the verse he's trying to explain says. He goes someplace completely different. But if you look at the final line of what he says in hundreds of different places, you come up with a philosophy that emphasizes very greatly human responsibility and human free will and the journey. I can't say too much more than that. There are a lot of corollaries of it. So we're going to try and make some head or tails of this. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be fun.
Very good. All right. And just to give us a scope, how long do you think that this will take in order to cover his philosophy?
It would take forever. We're only going to do 15 classes the second half of the year. That's all.
Okay.
For next year, I don't know what we're going to do. I think I once mentioned the possibility of studying next year not a subject, but rather a text. Perhaps just taking Maimonides' Guide to the Perplexed and studying it.
Oh, that's
so hard.
Well, I don't know, but that's very difficult.
Are we up to something like that?
Yes. Yes, indeed. But we can think further about that.
Yeah, maybe some other text that would... I would like to study some of the texts, but I don't know if I want to study my mind.
Well, we can do it in English translation. We don't have to do the original Arabic.
I don't understand anything he says.
Well, that's the point of studying, so that you know what he's saying.
I guess, yeah. Okay. Well,